Support for TPR Podcast comes from Port of Entry, a podcast filled with cross-border stories from cross-border people like you. Port of Entry zooms in on some of the interesting and unexpected ways the U.S. and Mexico are inextricably linked, despite the wall running between us. From KPBS and PRX, Port of Entry is available now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Get details at portofentrypod.org.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We all want to be a bit better, awesome in our lives, live our dreams, and have fewer problems. But how do you do that? Can the secret be found in a book, a self-help book? It's a multi-billion dollar industry. But do these programs and these books and these seminars, do they work and do they do harm? We're talking about self-help, these books, these programs, this literature, helpful or harmful. You can call in, tell us your experiences. Do you have one that you would recommend? 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're joined by Beth Blum, PhD, English professor at Harvard University, author of the book, The Self-Help Compulsion, Searching for Advice in Modern Literature. And Beth Blum, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
Also with us, Susan Whitborn, PhD, Professor Emerita of Psychological and Brain Sciences at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, Adjunct Professor of Gerontology at the University of Massachusetts Boston. And Susan Whitborn, great to have you today.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So, Beth, let me start off with a clip. This is from some people call him kind of the modern day father of self-help. This is some Dale Carnegie.
There's a deep, gnawing human hunger that is rarely gratified. The deepest principle in human nature is the craving to be appreciated.
And within 4 months, four small months after signing up for the Dale Carnegie course, I received the promotion. And 12 months after that, I was promoted to zone sales manager of the Burroughs Corporation.
May I give you one little bit of advice? Please. When you're talking to somebody, why not let the other person finish what he's saying?
I know. I do it all the time.
Well, maybe you ought to take the course instead of Mr. Jiggs.
Mr. Carnegie! I didn't come here to be insulted.
Yes, Mr. Carnegie. You might have made a few friends, but you didn't influence any people here tonight.
Beth Blum, why is Dale Carnegie the big figure in this self-help culture?
Well, Dale Carnegie, he's a classic figure in self-help, and an interesting fact about him is that when he went to the universities, he went to NYU and Columbia and said, I have this great course on public speaking, can I teach it here? And they said no, and so he had to go to the Harlem YMCA, where he offered his first public speaking courses, which eventually grew into his self-help program and inspired his famous book from 1936, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And I think that the reason he was so important is because he really tapped into a growing emphasis in the early 20th century on the idea of reputation as being really crucial and essential to success. So people started to realize that success wasn't just about expertise or skill, but about what people thought of you and your reputation. And Carnegie taught how to manipulate what other people think in order to climb the corporate ladder.
The key word there is manipulate. A lot of harsh criticism for his book when it was published. James Thurber called it manipulative and simplistic, like Dale Carnegie and his followers.
Yeah, I mean, Marshall McLuhan also took a great issue with Dale Carnegie, and especially Dale Carnegie's line that he wasn't just offering a kind of shortcut solution, but what he was talking about was a whole way of life. And McLuhan thought, how horrifying to have this be your way of life. But at the same time, there are really some valuable insights that Carnegie offers. Even in that clip, we saw the importance of just listening to what other people are saying, to be genuinely interested in what the other has to say, to express our appreciation for other people. Those aren't really pernicious pieces of advice. They're actually quite useful, I think. So,
Susan Whitborn, what's about the science of self-help? We see a lot of these books try to mask themselves in science. Is there science that supports their claims?
There can be science buried deep within the verbiage, and I think...
Oh, we lost Susan Whitborn. But so Beth Blum, can you talk about that for a moment?
Well, there's a statistic that people like to cite in the self-help publishing industry. It's called the 18-month rule. And the rule is that the person most likely to buy a book on a specific self-help topic is someone who has previously bought a book on the same topic in the past 18 months. So critics of the industry cite that as proof that, in fact, these self-help books don't really work, and that the industry really depends on repeat buyers and repeat customers. So apparently, about 80% of self-help readers are repeat customers.
Yeah, so you have to wonder, like, why do you have to keep buying new books? You go to the bookstore section of this self-help category. It's huge. There's books on, like, how to find your soulmate, how to save your marriage, how to survive your divorce. If the first book worked, why do you need the other ones?
Right. I mean, so that suggests that there's a kind of an addictive quality to self-help, which is why my book is called The Self-Help Compulsion. There's something kind of compulsive about our need to always be finding advice and to be returning to books over and over again to find little tidbits of useful information. At the same time, there's something kind of beautiful about that desire to find meaning in one's life, to listen to what other people have to say, to learn from the experiences of others. Throughout civilization, humans have produced a really remarkable archive of advice on how to survive and how to cope, and self-help is part of that in constructive ways as well as sometimes potentially detrimental ways.
And some of those ancient texts are still read today voraciously. You see a lot of people online talking about Marcus Aurelius and his meditations.
That's right. Stoicism is having a huge renaissance right now. There's a lot of interest in Stoicism due to these popular self-help figures and life coaches like Timothy Ferris and Ryan Holiday, who are returning to, I think, the idea of learning to distinguish between the things you can control and you can't control in your life, and learning to kind of adjust your expectations and your focus to those things that are within your control.
All right, let's go to the phone lines. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. What is your experience with self-help literature, and what do you recommend? And John is on the line. John, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you so much. By the way, awesome program as always. I'm a big proponent for self-help. I've seen, you know, myself grow over the years, and I think it's kind of what you had what you were talking about a while ago about why do people keep going back to this. I don't think it's not because it doesn't work. I think that they just like it so much. It's kind of like the Japanese concept of Kaizen, continuous improvement. So if one book improves me and helps me see things from one perspective, then the other book maybe mirrors that or complements that. And so we keep looking to get better and better. I think it's because we get the results. One of my favorite books over time was Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And that's been published, you know, in different languages all over the world. And it kind of just sets up some guidelines to follow to have a good, successful life. And I think that's important because we don't always get that guidance from others. Maybe we don't get it from our family. Maybe our family was kind of negative instead of positive. And just like little sayings by Zig Ziglar and so forth, little simple things like, if it's meant to be, it's up to me. You know, I like to program myself daily with positive affirmations. And generally, life works out great. I'm a survivor of head and neck cancer, actually a thriver, better off now than I was before. And a lot of it, I think, is how I program myself daily.
John, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate what you have to say. And I also support those thoughts. Susan Whitborn, welcome back. Sorry, you got cut off there. What about just the experience of reading these books? Okay, if there's some sort of scientific evidence saying this stuff doesn't work. Yeah. But if you buy into it and you really put it to use in your life, maybe you will have a better life.
Well, there is the placebo effect. We certainly know about that. But let me just say, I had written a blog back on my Psychology Today blog, Fulfillment in Any Age. And people can check this out because I talked about five ways to kind of guide yourself through reading self-help books and figuring out if they're right for you. And as I started saying, I think before I was cut off, I mean, key among these guidelines is checking out the author's credentials. You really want somebody who knows what they're talking about. And there are ways to check this out. The easiest, quite honestly, is Google. Find out who they're affiliated with. And then two, thinking about the book kind of as your therapist. A good self-help book will follow the principles of good therapy. And we heard a little bit about that with Dale Carnegie. You know, listening is a great skill to have. But there are ways to look at a book that might be kind of that you can connect with, what's called the therapeutic alliance, where you feel that you're reading a book that really speaks to you. And then number three, looking critically at the quality of the writing. Make sure that the actual rules of grammar are followed. Spelling, typos, sloppiness is probably an indication, just like if you were buying something on Amazon and the description had typos in it, you might not want to buy that product. So similarly with self-help books. And then I think looking at what will motivate you and will get you from the beginning to the end of the book, something if that really resonates with you will allow you to read the whole book, get to the author's point, understand the stories, understand the examples, and apply it to your own life.
Beth Blum, author of The Self-Help Compulsion, Searching for Advice in Modern Literature. Quality of writing, that's an interesting way of looking at these. How is the quality of writing generally?
Well, self-help authors, they like quotation. They're very fond of kind of plucking quotations from other authors, and whether literary authors or nonfiction or biographies, and kind of inserting them into their own book. And they'll often say, you know, this book is not really saying anything new. Dale Carnegie says that, many others say that, but what they're trying to do is offer kind of reminders. So I think it's, if it's taken in that spirit as kind of a helpful reminder of certain techniques one can use, to improve different areas of life or to learn to think more positively in certain moments, that can be very useful. I think any self-help book that asks of a reader more than to spend, you know, the $15 to $20 a paperback cost might be suspect to me. So I think that's how I would, where I would draw the line in terms of thinking about how devoted to become to these books.
If you just get taken for $15 for a book, then you pretty much got off easy, because there are a lot of programs that they bring you in and you end up spending a lot more for seminars and classes and other type of gizmos that are supposed to help you live right and achieve your dreams. They are selling you a dream. So, I mean, those exist as well, Beth.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, if you've seen the recent Netflix documentary, The Vow, about the cult Nexium, There's a member of a former member of the cult who says, you know, nobody joins a cult. Nobody thinks to themselves, today I'm going to sign up for a cult. What they do think to themselves is, today I'm going to a self-improvement seminar or a personal growth seminar. So that's where self-help can become dangerous and pernicious. At the same time, in academia, we tend to only focus on that side. So I'm glad the caller brought up the more constructive aspects of the industry as well.
Yeah, it can be very helpful. It can be constructive, but there's talking about self-improvement through taking responsibility for your own life. But then there's a whole science of wishful thinking and whether or not that will actually bring good things into your life and improve your quality of life. We're going to take a break. Our phone lines are open. How have you experienced self-help? Has it made a difference? Has it hurt you? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about self-help books and programs that want to max your potential, help you accumulate wealth, get you healthy, get your motivation going, become a better leader, make all of your dreams come true. Wow, what a great thing. But is it actually a waste of time? Are they marketing a fantasy is this something that can actually be toxic and addictive in of itself? How have you experienced self-help? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, and you can text us at that number as well. We're bringing now into the conversation Chris Taylor, deputy editor for Mashable, and Mashable has had a series called Me, My Self-Care, and I. Chris Taylor, welcome to The Source.
Nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So you've read a lot of self-help books to do the series, I imagine.
Yes, in the story that I wrote, where I boiled all my self-help book advice down to 11 rules, I said that I'd read dozens of books. It's that's sort of a vague sense of explaining how many books I kind of sped read and skim read. Basically, I went on this project to try and establish how, you know, just how many rules could you boil self-help books down to. And once I got to 11, I got to a point where I could pick up a new self-help book and just kind of scroll through it, see what it was actually saying when you take all those anecdotes out, when you take all those studies out. And yeah, I got to a point where they just weren't telling me anything new. And that's where I knew I had, you know, the ultimate list of self-help advice.
So with all that self-help knowledge in your head, you must be living the ultimate life.
You know, it's interesting. It was all stuff that I sort of knew. You know, it's all stuff that kind of makes sense when you look at it. Like, you know, the golden rule is kind of basically self-help, but you've got to adjust it a little bit. It's not just do unto others as you would want to have done. It's do unto others as they would want to have done, right? You've got to be useful to them rather than just think that they act the same way that you do, right? So it's a little tweak on an old rule. But it's a lot of it are old rules, and a lot of it predate what we think of as self-help, which really started in the 19th century. You know, it really goes back to the Stoics, a lot of this, you know, and this sense of how do we approach life? How do we approach the difficulties of life? You know, this is something we've been thinking of for thousands of years, and we haven't necessarily come up with better rules than the ancient Greeks did.
That's cool. This is another clip I'd like to play. Another massive guru in the pantheon of self-help. This is Norman Vincent Peale.
Believe, and then form a picture in your mind of that goal. Hold it tenaciously in the conscious mind until by a process of intellectual osmosis, it sinks into the unconscious. And when it gets into the unconscious, you have it because it will have all of you. I would go so far as to say that if you are a complete, dedicated follower of Jesus Christ, you can do anything you really want to do with your life.
Beth Blum, author of The Self-Help Compulsion, Searching for Advice in Modern Literature. Norman Vincent Peale, how influential is he in the self-help world?
Well, tremendously influential, not just in the self-help world, but also, of course, he was the pastor of Donald Trump and his family. So we really see that premise, the emphasis on mind power, the idea that just by saying something, you can make it so, you can make it true in the political realm as well as in the self-help realm. But yeah, Peale extends from this tradition called New Thought, which was a late 19th century movement that really initiated this idea of mind power. So a popular book from that time was called Thoughts Are Things. It was published in 1908. And the idea there was that your mind really determines your reality. So attitude is very important. And you can see how that would extend from the Stoics and their emphasis on thinking and learning to adjust one's mindset to what is.
But you can see the limits of what Norman Vincent Peale is promising. And he was doing this from the pulpit as a religious figure as well. We see people crossing paths in that way, but it doesn't matter how positive Donald Trump's thoughts are. He's not going to change, like, for example, the numbers of this most recent election. He still lost. So
that's right. Yeah. And self-help is often criticized for precisely that. And I think we are seeing the limits of that, for failing to recognize the kind of structural and social limits of just, using our mind to attain our every desire.
In the face of reality. Here's an email received from Brent. I'm 34 years old and I have bought various self-help books over the past 10 years or so. My girlfriend says I'm addicted to them. Can you be addicted to self-help books? Is there a self-help book that you would recommend to deal with that? And so Susan Whitborn, can you get addicted to self-help?
Oh, you can definitely get addicted to self-help. And I think the examples you've been presenting of these very charismatic speakers becomes part of that equation. And it's true. It's not just the book. It's everything that goes with it. It's the websites. It's the stuff that you pay for as add-ins. It could even be an app that takes you through these steps of whatever the help is supposed to be. But yes, it's addictive. And like many things that are addictive, first of all, it takes one big win to get you hooked. So something really resonates with you, something really works, and now you want to find that again. So you keep looking, and then you get a little bit of reinforcement when you find a kernel of truth or help in something. The next thing that you look at, that then keeps you going. If eventually nothing you found would work at all, then you might be able to cure yourself of that addiction and say, okay, just like we heard, you know, I've read enough self-help books. I think I know what they're about and I can move on.
Chris Taylor, as you write about self-help books, we're at Mashable. And we heard Susan Whitborn just told us earlier about look at who's writing these books and look at them critically. But who do you see writing these books? What gives them credibility?
There is a wide variety of people. And this is one thing about writing self-help books, right? There's no qualification necessary. Anyone can do it. And indeed, a lot of people are doing it, you know, based on the sort of flimsiest part of their own experiences. Because everyone does have some advice that has a kernel of truth in it, right? A lot of it taps into these same ancient truths. So there's just a wide variety of people with a wide variety of qualifications.
Don't they frequently have a similar narrative, like I was a hot mess and now I have a Lamborghini parked in my garage?
Yeah. And they'll often bring in stories from their own family. There's a recent self-help book called Someday Is Not a Day in the Week. That I believe talks about the author's father and how he always wanted to go visit every national park. And then he died the day before he retired, you know, a tragic story that makes for sort of good self-help reading and illustrates a point of, you know, carpe diem. But again, that's a very ancient point, right? That we can all explain through our own experiences.
Let's go to another caller. And Julia is on the phone. So Julia, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, I think that I tend towards self-help books that have been recommended to me by someone I trust, like a psychologist or a therapist. And so one of my favorite self-help books is The Disease to Please, which taught me a lot about my tendency for people-pleasing. And that was recommended to me by a therapist, so I feel like I can trust it more.
And how is it? How have you actualized that book?
So I think that I will now notice more my tendencies to when I act out in ways that I'm only doing this to please other people in my life. I'll be more aware of it in my regular day-to-day activities.
Awesome. Well, thank you for calling in. And Beth Blum, if you could tell us about, you know, a book like, have you heard of that book?
Well, I haven't heard of that book, but it strikes me as part of a really popular movement or trend in the most recent wave of self-help literature, which is really about undoing the damages of old self-help. So whereas the old Dale Carnegie self-help would say, try to please everybody, try to win friends and influence people, the new self-help is saying, stop caring so much what other people think. Try to find your kind of sense of value and self-worth within yourself instead, or use some other criteria. So I think there's a real interest in kind of thinking about a future for self-help that is not so dependent on this kind of corporate model of just trying to manipulate people or win friends and such.
And Susan Whitborn, it seems to be, this is my observation, two different ways of looking at these books. One of them is inward focusing. I'm trying to build up my self-confidence. And then there's outward focusing where I'm trying to get better at manipulating others, like influencing people.
Yeah, that's a good point. But I want to respond to that earlier email because I like that example a lot because the therapist knows you and is going to suggest what I would assume would be a kind of a reliable source. And if it's a book that fits in with the overall theme of a person's therapy, I think that's a great way to go. And there are, I mean, I know mostly about psychology self-help books because that's my field, but there are a lot of books on things like cognitive behavioral therapy for depression. I mean, they're written for a popular audience, and it's taking something that you would get from a therapist, but showing you how to work your way through the steps of this really very well-researched and empirically based program. And then I think a good self-help book will say, hey, if this didn't work, you might want to consider, and then send you to resources. And again, I'm talking about more psychology, but and I suppose that is more inward focused. And so many of the psychology self-help books really are about understanding yourself. And some of the great psychologists have written some of the best self-help books that there are, like Maslow. So go to some of those sources, and I think they can be very beneficial.
All right, I'm okay, and you're okay. Let's continue talking about self-help books and how they can help or how they can be harmful. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're taking a break, and we'll be right back.
Support for TPR Podcast comes from Port of Entry, a podcast filled with cross-border stories from cross-border people like you. Port of Entry zooms in on some of the interesting and unexpected ways the U.S. and Mexico are inextricably linked, despite the wall running between us. From KPBS and PRX, Port of Entry is available now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Get details at portofentrypod.org.
Pioneering public radio reporter Maria Martin trains journalists in Guatemala, where it often seems the civil war is still being fought.
These journalists are caught between a rock and a hard place in a culture that does not understand the idea of independent journalism.
And how rehabbing shotgun homes could alleviate a housing affordability crisis. Download Fronteras wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
So step number one, decide to develop the habit right now, the habit of focusing on what's right in your world instead of what's wrong, the habit of focusing on what you do have instead of what you don't have in a situation. And as basic as that is, and as well as you know it, you've got to make it a habit, because those habits form the chain of your ultimate character, of who you become and how you end up living your life. We've got to condition ourselves, because if we don't, we'll go back to the automatic state that most people live in today's society.
We're talking about self-help. That's Tony Robbins. A lot of people know him from his work, trying to unleash the giant within. Chris Taylor, deputy editor for Mashable. You had the series Me, Myself, Care, and I. Tony, I mean, that's good advice. That's great advice. Can't deny that.
It is. You can't deny it. Habits are certainly important. An interesting thing has happened over the last 10 years or so. We've had a lot of books on the science of habits. The Power of Habit, I think, was one of the most successful.
Atomic
ones.
Habits?
Yes, Atomic Habits, Mini Habits. I kind of like Mini Habits because it had this quote that I put in my story on the 11 Rules of Self-Help. Make your daily practice too small to fail. You know, so if you want to exercise, just exercise for 5 minutes every day, and then you'll feel this natural urge to build it up, right? This is how we've discovered and how we're still discovering that the human brain works. You know, small habits every day make it too small to fail.
But when we take an individual like Tony Robbins and we turn him into someone who's been able to tell us a few good bits of good advice and then turn him into this guru that everything that falls out of his gaping maw is gold, we run into problems. And Chris, have you seen that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's not for nothing that I believe Robbins called his Netflix special, I Am Not Your Guru. And you know, a lot of self-help people sort of say this till they're blue in the face. You know, you can't get everything from me. If they're not saying that, by the way, that they're a cult, not a self-help person. But you know, it's we do have this tendency to look to people to be character focused, to be person focused. You know, the very first self-help book in 1859 was actually called Self Help, written by Samuel Smiles. And it was just a series of profiles of people, you know, people you should look up to because they rose up the ladder. But yeah, I do think we get into trouble when we make it so character focused, even though our brains desire that. You know, no one person has the answer. No one book has the answer. And you have to do a lot of the work yourself. They can't do it for you.
Let's go to the phones with Dorothy. And Dorothy, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to point out that some of these people who are writers in this genre make claims they can't provide evidence of. Some of them, perhaps many of them, start out with full-page ads claiming that I was poor and totally broke and homeless, and then I had this magic thing happen, and now look at me. I have millions, and I have cars and boats and all the women I want, and on and on. They're regurgitating. Many people that get into this writing business and this cult, which I call it, because they promote each other, They go out and meet as many celebrities as they can and get their photographs made with them so they can show it off to impress people. And they go to other seminars by other writers. They meet them, and once they start congratulating either and recommending each other's books on the back of their books, they all say the same thing. They're regurgitating previous writers from the 1800s, the 1900s, Peel and Carnegie and Robbins and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Many of them are not motivated by helping people. I think they inadvertently, some of them help people by the things that they repeat from other writers, perhaps, or some knowledge that is universally known to be well.
Dorothy, thank you for the call. And so also to kind of help stress, I think, where she's getting at, this is another clip, and this is from Jan La Van Zandt.
Impossible doesn't really exist. Not because it cannot, but because it actually does not. You see, at the root, the core, the essence of impossible lives possible. This being the case, since everything grows up and out from the root, it is impossible for you or anything else to be void of powerful possibilities at any given moment. So, beloved, now that you know that anything is possible because impossible has no roots, what is it that you believe is possible for you right now? And what is keeping you from being all that you could possibly be? After all, anything is possible.
Jan La Van Zandt. So it sounds like she's just spouting gibberish, Susan Whitborn.
Yes, well, anything is possible. Who can deny? And I think what Chris was saying about, I'm not sure if you exactly said this, but I kind of heard that the sort of disprovability needs to be there. Just like you would, they're always trying to confirm. And what you want to do when you're being exposed to this sort of, gibberish, is to really take a hard look at that. Are you being led? Are you being manipulated? Are you the one that they're making all the money off of that they're bragging about in their books? And if so, then you really need to take a very skeptical approach, which I think in general is a good idea, as you would with medical advice. You wouldn't just accept the first TV ad that you see for the latest prescription drug. You're going to do some research on it, I hope, or if it's something purported by a natural food company, you're going to do your research. Do your research with the self-help writers, especially the current ones, because there are so many of them, and they riff off each other, as we've just heard, and they're just out there to make that buck off of you.
Here's another caller, Janie. Hi, Janie. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you. I am one in the middle of 10 children. So you can imagine, there was not a lot of time for personal. But I love the self-help books because they do give me positive affirmations.
All right, we're losing that call, but Janie's talking about how she loves self-help books. They give her a lot of positive affirmation. There's a lot of positive energy in the books, and that can make a difference in people who are dealing with tough times. Beth Blum.
Yeah, well, I think... even as we heard in that clip, there could be a kind of inspirational function to some of self-help. So it could sound like gibberish, but what if it gives a reader or a listener a jolt to go apply for that job that they had been too scared to apply for, or to ask someone on a date that they've been intimidated by? So there can be a kind of instigation provided by self-help that can be useful and inspirational or affirmative, as the caller said. On the other hand, the problem with this idea that nothing is impossible is that this implies that failure is your own personal responsibility. And so another implication of this is the idea that if somebody is poor, for example, this means that they weren't thinking properly or they weren't visualizing properly. So the way that it puts all of this onus on the responsibility of the individual is a potential danger of that kind of mentality.
And Chris Taylor, isn't there the possibility of a survivor bias in as we look at the results of these books? I got the motivation to go up and apply for the job, but I didn't get the job and the girl shot me down, and now I'm not any better than I was before.
Yeah, I mean, confirmation bias is certainly a thing, and that's something I would encourage people to keep in mind, not just when probing self-help books, but also, you know, conspiracy theories online. They spread through confirmation bias, right? I have this conclusion, this political opinion that I want to reach, and this theory is helping me getting there, therefore I'm going to believe it more. I think confirmation bias comes out a lot with self-help books because we spend, $15 at the store. If the book doesn't work for you, then you're down $15 and a whole bunch of time reading it, right? So you are predisposed to believe whatever it says, because then that confirms that you were a smart person for buying the book in the first place. But that, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that what the book is saying is true. I think we all remember The Secret from 2006, which was a book that basically said, you know, the law of attraction is real. You know, kind of what that last clip was saying, right? If you think you can do it, you know, nothing's impossible. You just have to dream it. You have to imagine it. Well, you need a lot more concrete steps than that.
All right, let's go to Kevin on the phones. Kevin, welcome to The Source.
Hi, I was just, you know, some of them are really good. Like you have, like Brené Brown, I think she would be considered self-help. Dr. Wayne Dyer. And then you have the Esther Hicks and, you know, there's such a wide variety, but you know, you can get a lot of them books on tape at the library for free. Anyway, have a great day.
Well, thank you for that. So you can go to the library. You don't have to spend $15. You can find a lot of these books at the used bookstore. I bought a used self-help book 30 years ago. I still have it, and I just reread the same one over and over again. But Beth Blum, if you could, what is the big takeaway with self-help literature? How should it be seen or used?
Well, I suppose one thing to think about is what is the alternative to self-help literature right now? And I think one answer to that is what we're seeing with a kind of overprescription of psychotropics and therapeutic medications, and the very act of looking to a self-help book for help or for advice is actually becoming somewhat quaint, I think. But I would just echo what everyone else has said and say that one should approach every self-help book with a little bit of detachment, with curiosity and interest, but with a reminder of all the other sources of moral authority in one's life and a willingness to kind of compare these different value systems and decide for oneself who to follow.
And Chris Taylor, last words?
Yeah, I'd say the rule that I felt most applied to me was perfectionism is procrastination, and procrastination is perfectionism. I think reading multiple self-help books is a form of procrastination in itself. So, you know, folks feel like they're addicted to it. That's something to bear in mind. You may be avoiding your problems by reading too many of these books.
So just go out and live your best life now. Chris Taylor, deputy editor for Mashable, thank you so much. Susan Whitborn, professor emerita of psychological and brain sciences at University of Massachusetts Amherst, and also Beth Blum, English professor at Harvard University, Self-Help Compulsion, Searching for Advice in Modern Literature, the author. Thank you so much. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for joining us.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by Ruben Garcia and Kathleen Creedon. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.